Okay. Good afternoon. Like I was introduced, my name is Vance Holmquist. I am a PhD student at Oregon State University. And I was trying to think about how to introduce myself today, and I guess a couple of things. So, one, like I said, I'm a PhD student in my second year, and so I've been working through my oral exams lately. And so my mind is really full of questions. And so the idea with today's presentation is that I want to also kind of encourage you all to be thinking about a lot of questions as well. So with that being said, I guess a little bit of background is this is work that I was doing last year. This is basically stemming from my fieldwork in validating a predictive soil map. And so this is my first field season ever, and I'm given a shovel and just told to go out and dig a bunch of holes. And so I got really excited, you know, and I'm seeing things that I'm not really familiar with. I'm from Utah, and I'm in Oregon, and there are all these things. And so I just start digging holes, right, like we do, because, you know, that's what we do. So so that's what this is all about. Okay, so the first thing is I was kind of also doing a lot of literature review at the time, and there's something called the soil production function. And some of you may or may not be familiar with it, but what it is it's essentially, it's a mathematical abstraction or representation of the conversion of bedrock into soil, okay? And it can be either chemical weathering of some sort, or it can be physical weathering. It's not really, it doesn't really matter, it's just the rate of that conversion that's occurring. Okay, and so there are two styles. There's an exponential style, and then there's like a log normal style. Log normal style typically is called the hump soil production function. And so the one in exponential is basically claiming that there is no limit to the rate of soil production. It's just if you have a bare rock surface, it's going to be converted to soil faster than any other thickness of soil. So basically, if it was chemical weathering, it's just water can get there and weather fresh minerals, or if it's biological weathering or physical weathering, you can frost shattering is occurring at the surface a lot faster than if you have some cover of soil thickness. Kind of contrary to that is you have the humped soil production function, or the log normal soil production function, I'm going to try to call it that, and that says that there's some optimum soil thickness at which bedrock is converted into new soil fastest. And a little bit problematically with, maybe not problematically, but that there can be this instability on the left-hand side of that production function. And I guess what I was interested in was the soil production function is being looked at or is consistently talked about in the geomorphic literature, and a few soil scientists were working with it, but basically they've all agreed that maybe it's exponential. So basically the conversion of bedrock to soil appears to be exponential. But I kind of was, you know, as I was digging all these holes, I started wondering if that was true. And in particular, I wanted to point out that I think that there are a couple of things here. Again, it's the exponential production function. There's no limit to weathering. And that there's this instability predicted in soil thickness when you'll start stripping soil off if you're a little bit below that optimum. Okay. And so regionally where I am, where we're working is in eastern Oregon and central Oregon. And we are, a couple of important things about this is we are downwind of the Cascade Range volcanoes, volcanic center. And that is also downwind of all the Cascadian volcanism. And the Cascades also produce a rain shadow. So we've got both this continuous addition of material, and we've got some deficit of moisture. Okay, and this on the left side there is, this is essentially basically a chronology of volcanic eruptions that we know about for just the last 4,000 years. So not particularly long. And then we've got our precipitation map, and I'm kind of talking about this orange box here just right in the center of Oregon. And we're mostly, it can go down to the eritic soil moisture regime, and then we can come up into the eutic at high elevations. About 75 centimeters is where we're topping out in terms of our precip. And that's coming mostly snow. But the important thing here is that forest vegetation is basically responding to the thickness of an ash mantle. And that the ash here is critical for forest vegetation. Okay, So knowing that, I think I covered everything on that last slide. So knowing that, and this is an ape imagery of one section of the forest that I'm working in, or was working in, and this is basically illustrating a couple of things. One, we've got this really distinct patterning of vegetation. We've got these kind of, if you'll notice, these kind of bulb-looking patches, and then we've got forests. Regionally, it's called the scab and stringer terrain, and the stringers are the forests, and the scabs are the bare spots. And so here, this is basically, the forest locations are telling you where the ash is located. And the ash, again, it has a high available water, plant available water content, you know. It also retains some phosphorus, but it's really just ultimately related to total net primary productivity. So there's this interplay, and that was something that was alluded to earlier, that there's this interplay between soil or vegetation, geomorphology, and yeah. So I kind of look at the scab stringer terrain while I'm out there, and it's intriguing. You know, why is there this consistent patterning in the landscape? Why do we have these places that should be receiving the same precipitation? They have the same bedrock lithology, but they're completely different soil morphologies. And so, just for some backgrounds, a lot of what you're looking at there is bedrock-controlled hill slopes, basaltic lithology mostly, and kind of dipping to the southwest, or southeast, sorry. So, in my boredom, I decided to dig a catena. And so we've dug a number of holes out here. And so this catena is located in a zeroth order catchment. Hill slope aspect that the catena is going up on, and that's kind of these tiny little orange dots in the middle image there. Northwest aspect, slope degrees about 20% on average. Frigid mean annual soil temperature regime, and then we're receiving about 65 centimeters of precipitation. So we've got the bare earth LIDAR at about 5.5 kilometers on the far left, and then we're going to 500 meters in the center and then the far right. Bare earth LIDAR again in the middle, and then the NAEP imagery. And so the NAEP imagery is showing basically this vegetational mosaic that is referred to as the scab stringer terrain that you saw from the previous slide. And illustrated there is that we have more or less a bare knoll ringed by grasses, and then we transition into this forest vegetation. So the ecotone is, you know, rimming basically that scab. So here is the more or less the stratigraphy that resulted from digging those catena pedons, or this is basically the pedons from the catena. So our toe slope is on the left, and then we move up to our shoulder position on the right. And I've simplified the horizonation here to more or less give you pedostratigraphic units generally. And then in the center we're looking at, so here we're looking at, this is actually intact Mazama ash, and we took the strike and dip of, when we had preserved volcanic ash beds, we would take the strike and dip of those. So this is the 9 soil profiles located along there. Importantly, so we have one soil, so we within the field, we basically delineated, okay, well, we have one volcanic ash parent material full of cobbles, and then it looks like we've got a second pedostratigraphic unit here. So I just called it soil number 2. I don't know the ages of these. And then we have Mazama ash, so this would be our third soil. So if we can, and I'll show you in the next slide, sort of our actually tracing these across. Let's see, so what are the, yeah, importantly, we've got some bedrock outcropping. This, for scale, is about 2.2 meters, something like that. And then for those soils which just have an unbounded section down here, that's 1.5 meters. And again, I had to dig a bunch of other holes, so this was kind of on the side. So I'd stop at about 1.5 meters, or until I hit bedrock. So, and then we're looking at an elevational cross-section of the transect, so you can see where each pedon is located. And then, of course, all of the subgroups that you'd see along that transect are in the bottom. So, and actually, well, yeah. Okay, so importantly for this slide is that we've got a cobbly cobbly ash mantle here. We transition. Oh boy. Okay. We transition into some cobble-filled ash with unweathered Mount Mazama here, our second soil and our third soil, and then just reworked Mount Mazama here. And so what I started putting together was that this soil stratigraphy is really equivalent to the migration of the ecotone. So moving between forest vegetation and a scab, okay? And really invoking the idea of Walther's Law that things which are laterally adjacent and can be dynamically moving, you'll end up seeing them stacked in sequence vertically. Okay, and that importantly here, trees are driving this colluviation. Basically, tree throw is slowly excavating fresh ashes off of these scabs. So, and the idea here is also that cover beds, which are a European idea, which record periglacial climate and movement of material downslope as a function of different climatic signals, that here in the Ojiko, actually, we're recording the differences in vegetation driven largely by plant-available water in terms of paramaterial additions. So this is, again, looking at the transect in which we're tracing our pedostratigraphic units. Colluvium 1, which is our oldest soil, pinches out by the time we're to our third transect site. And then we've got our second soil, which we can trace laterally just about up to the top, where it's only found in little cracks. And then we trace fresh Mazama ash and then a cobbly Mazama ash. Cobbly Mazama ash here is equivalent to, stratigraphically looks really similar to, colluvium number 2. Colluvium number 1 is an older version. It's also cobbly infilled, or cobbly ash is equivalent to colluvium 2. And so if we think of this in terms of our, onlap and offlap, this is an offlapping sequence in which each time we record the trees regressing back into the drainage. And so consistently across the forest, and this is the digital soil map from the forest, you can find these buried soil horizons with or without colluvium and with or without preserved volcanic tephra. And so what I'm wondering, I guess, with this is we have a consistent geomorphic patterning and we see the stripping of a landscape. So to me this suggests, I don't think we have an exponential soil production function because I'm not sure what we have, but it seems like we've got some stripping that is occurring periodically. So I guess I'm asking you all to think about what really does describe what's going on these hill slopes. Is it a simple soil production function? Is it complex? Is it maybe, this is my joke, you know, does it have many humps? With each time you have an airfall, you get some stripping of your free regolith. So each time you produce parent material to be weathered into a new soil, you actually strip it off each time with airfalls. So I would say in Central Oregon, and who knows, regionally, there may not be one soil production function which can describe the way in which bedrock is converted into soil, and that we as soil scientists should be thinking about helping some people who are more geomorphically minded kind of parse these out, I would suggest. And so that is, I guess, my conclusions and implications, and that's that soil stratigraphy suggests episodic stripping and that the landscape may be potentially transient, and that observation of these local facies is important for delineating this relationship. And also importantly, what are the implications for cosmogenic radionuclides if you were to try to measure this, the lowering of the weathering front? So with that, any questions?
Thanks.
We have time for half a question, so a very short one.
Yeah. Do you have any evidence from the soil pits that you dug that the soils are actually forming from a consolidated bedrock? I mean, it looks to me like everything you're talking about is airfall tephra, and then the production function from bare bedrock may not be the appropriate model to use in this case. But I'm just wondering if you could talk about the extent to which bedrock is actually being weathered in the soil.
Yeah, sure. So this picture is actually from the top of the knoll. And this is approximately, maybe 10 centimeter thick soil. It's just clay for the most part, cobbly clay. So there's evidence that we have residual soils up on these knolls, but they're really quite thin. And as you trace the older soils downslope, these colluvium 2s and colluvium 1s, they're actually admixed ash. So they do have a fair amount of clay. They're not necessarily argillic horizons. They're just, they have some degree of clay in them. And I think that, to me, this is evidence that we have weathering out on the knolls or out on the scabs, and just bioturbative processes are actually admixing clays that are generated from these, you know, from the bedrock in with the ash. I mean, certainly there's some neogenesis from the ash, but I mean, I think when you know, if I had colors included in here, you could start to see some reddening that's going on, which I think is coming from the basalt. So there is evidence of basaltic bedrock weathering, but yeah.
Thank you, Vince.